August 19th. And we'll be right back with you in a second.
The Cleveland IMC is a not-for-profit, volunteer, and collectively run organization working in solidarity with the International Network of Independent Media Centers to create a viable alternative to traditional media sources. The Cleveland IMC will provide public access to passionate, accurate, and honest information about important events and issues. We seek to empower people of diverse communities by providing an alternative source of information and a forum for active participation. We hope this resource will help people to make educated decisions that will affect their lives and communities in a positive way.
The views expressed in the Cleveland IMC Radio Hour are those of the producer and or guests of the show. They are not necessarily those of WRUW or Case Western Reserve University.
That you have learned by experience that I do not tolerate interference, I will now detonate the nuclear warhead.
Okie dokie. With that in mind, we've got quite the... quite the show for you here today, folks. the blackout. What happened?
Who put out the lights?
Who turned the lights out? Well, we've got a lot of information on that. We have been scouring the internet for all of its hidden treasures all weekend long, and we now have quite a comprehensive report to provide for you. Also in the show, we're going to be discussing the Blue Triangle Protest Network and the organization itself, as well as its involvement with the Kent family, who is struggling to get back their father and husband, who is being held without reason down in Kent. Also, the American Friends Service Committee couple, who lived in Baghdad for a couple of years and returned recently to discuss their experience living there. An interview with someone from the Lakewood Skaters organization. We finally got that little glitch figured out, and that should be coming out this week, or, yeah, later on in the hour here. Perhaps a discussion with a certain film person later on if they decide to show up. And, of course, our national briefs, our news of the future and announcements, and a little song here and there for you. All that when we come back in just 1 second. Okay, that was about 1 second. Or 10.
Not very long at all.
Oh. I got that.
So this microphone doesn't really sound all that great.
Well, we can turn you down.
Well, let's try that. Because I'm coming back over to Studio C. I can't listen
okay,
to
come on. Hurry up. Basically, Bob's going to read the first part of our story. The Cleveland blackout. The Northeast America blackout. The largest blackout in North American history. So what do you think the cause of it was? We've got a little multiple choice for you. Was it A, terrorists? Was it B, rogue weather patterns? C, corrupt energy companies? D, corrupt government? E, C, and D? F, 12-year-old hackers? G, none of the above? Or H, I don't care, I got paid, lights go on, lights go off, no big deal, as long as it didn't bother me.
Huh.
Well,
there's so many possible answers.
Well, basically, I'm going to give you a hint, and I'm going to say it has something to do with C and D.
One of the letters is probably correct.
So we're going to start the story off with a first-hand account from a Clevelander who was actually stuck down in North Carolina during the whole fiasco. And because our Cleveland Indie Media server is not located in northeast portion of America, we're actually hosted out in Seattle. We were up and running, and some Cleveland people from around the country started posting immediately about corporate media coverage. And with that first leg of our story, here's Stav, and we'll follow that up with a little brief history of what led up to the blackout.
Well, on Thursday at 8 p.m., Lippy posted this. I'm sitting here in Raleigh, and my roommate calls me up and says, Lippy, the power's out. At first, I thought I forgot to pay the bill, and I was like, gosh darn it. About an hour later, my mom tells me that there's an impending water shortage in Cleveland, and so, in lieu of any real news source, I turn on the TV. ABC is running an aerial shot of our lovely city and then cuts to a WEWS anchor standing in a Sunoco parking lot. The caption reads, Nuclear Power Plant, Perry, Ohio.
We'll get to that later.
Throughout the next half hour, I repeatedly hear about nuclear power plants and hospitals on the verge of doom and fears of widespread arson and looting in New York City. Needless to say, nothing bad actually happens. But I am concerned when I hear on every major network that Cleveland has doubled its police force. A curfew will be imposed. Water will only last a few more hours, and no one knows when the power will be restored. Mayor Jane Campbell is interviewed by phone on MS News, MSNBC, apparently without a script of any sort. She less than eloquently explains the water situation. When asked to clarify the curfew restrictions, she responds, "Well, those 18 and under may not go out, but we're asking the others to stay in as well."
I think I know who the others are, but we'll get to that later, too.
To stay at home and take care of their families. She blusters a bit about efforts to get in touch with all of the people on oxygen, and then thankfully the interview is over. During the next few hours, no new information is aired on any of the major stations about Cleveland. They are tripping over themselves to keep me updated on the return of power to New York City, block by painstaking block. I'm surprised their helicopters haven't crashed into each other. The most disturbing thing is that they all start to refer to this as a reminder of 9/11. It's weird how this phrase is picked up and bandied around incessantly. They also keep repeating that they knew 5 minutes into it that this is not the result of a terrorist attack. After about the 100th reiteration, I turned the TV off. At this point, I'm certain that if it had been a terrorist attack, they would have exploited it to the last tier.
Actually, during the last terrorist attack, no one did what I did last Thursday. We threw a bonfire and like all our friends and family came over. Neighbors, random people. It was fun.
Fire.
But anyway, see, that's the great thing about... that's wonderful. Thank you, Lippy, for letting us know what was going on. Most of us in Cleveland had no way of knowing what was going on because, we had no functioning media. And one person who did know what was going on was Greg Palast. He was actually located in the Northeast, but he would luckily had his laptop all charged up with batteries and had a satellite internet hookup. Within hours of this happening, Mr. Palast posted to every single indie media site, I think, in the world. And he reports, he points towards the Niagara Mohawk Power Company, an English power company, and George Bush, both of George Bush's, and Governor Pataki of New York. Anyway, he wrote on Friday, August 15th, "I can tell you about the ne'er-do-wells that put out our lights Thursday night. I came up against these characters, the Niagara Mohawk Power Company, some years back. You see, I worked as an investigator of corporate racketeers. In the 1980s, NEMO, that's the nickname for Niagara Mohawk, built a nuclear plant called Nine Mile Point, a brutally costly piece of hot junk for which NEMO and his partner companies charged billions to New York State's electricity ratepayers. To pull off this grand theft by kilowatt, the NEMO-led consortium fabricated cost and scheduled reports, then performed a Harry Potter job on the account books. Here's what happened. After a few energy companies were hammered by the law, after government regulators slammed dozens of bookkeeping, document doctoring utility companies all over America with fines and penalties totaling in the tens of billions of dollars, the industry leaders got together to swear never to break the regulations again. Their plan was not to follow the rules, but to eliminate the rules. They called it deregulation." Well, you could hear that everywhere. They called it deregulation. "It was like a committee of bank robbers figuring out how to make a safe cracking legal. But they dare not launch their scheme in the USA. Rather, in 1990, one devious little bunch of operators out of Texas, Houston Natural Gas, operating under the alias Enron, talked an over-the-edge free market fanatic, Britain's Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher, into licensing the first completely deregulated power plant in the hemisphere. The power elite moved first on England because they knew Americans wouldn't swallow the deregulation snake oil easily. The USA had gotten used to cheap power available at the flick of a switch. The Federal Power Commission and the Public Utilities Holding Company Act told electricity companies where to stand and salute. Detailed regulations limited charges to real expenditures plus a government-set profit. The laws banned power markets and required companies to keep the lights on under threat of arrest. Of particular significance, regulators told utilities exactly how much they had to spend to ensure the system stayed in repair and the lights stayed on. Bureaucrats crawled along the wire and, like me, crawled through the account books to make sure the power execs spent customers' money on parts and labor. If they didn't, we'd whack them over the head with our thick rule books. Did we get in the way of the businessman's entrepreneurial spirit? Yeah, we did. Most important, before deregulation, political contributions from utility companies were not allowed at all, period. But then came George I, and in 1992, just prior to his departure from the White House, President Bush Sr. gave the power industry one long, deep, through-the-teeth kiss goodbye. Federal deregulation of electricity was a legacy he wanted to leave for his son. The Gratitude of Power companies, which ponied up $16 million for the Republican campaign of 2000, seven times the amount they gave Democrats. But Pompey Bush's gift of deregulation of wholesale prices set by the feds only got the power pirates halfway to the plunder of Joe Ratepayer. For the big payday, they needed deregulation at the state level. There were only two states, California and Texas, big enough and Republican enough to put the electricity market con into operation. Well, California fell first, of course. In the Deregulation Act's preamble, the legislature promised that deregulation would reduce electricity bills by 20%, when, in fact, San Diegans in the first California city to go lawless looked at their bills. The 20% savings became a 300% jump in surcharges. It took until December 20th, 2000, with the lights going out on the Golden Gate, for President Bill Clinton, once a deregulation booster, to find his lost Democratic soul and impose price caps in California and ban Enron from the market. But the lightbulb buccaneers didn't have to wait long to put their hooks back into the treasure chest. Within 72 hours of moving into the White House, while he still was sweeping out the inaugural champagne bottles, George Bush II reversed Clinton's executive order and put the power pirates back in business in California. Meanwhile, the deregulation bug made it to New York, where Republican Governor George Pataki and his industry-picked utility commissioners ripped the lid off electric bills and relieved my old friends at Niagara Mohawk of the expensive obligation to properly fund the maintenance of the grid system. Now, I want to break in here real quick and let you know that Pataki was very upset when he was seen on TV Friday. If anybody saw that, Pataki was like fuming. He didn't even know what to say. But this will all make sense in a second. As Palast goes on to explain, in the Pataki-Bush axis of weasels allowed a foreign company, the notoriously incompetent National Grid of England, to buy up NEMO, get rid of 800 workers, and pocket most of their wages, producing a bonus for NEMO stockholders approaching $90 million. The free market cowboys of Niagara Mohawk raised prices, slashed staff, cut maintenance, and click. New York joins the dark ages. So Mr. Palast concludes, sitting in the dark as my laptop battery runs low, I don't know if the truth about deregulation will ever see the light until we change the dim bulb in the White House. So that's the history of deregulation and how it is that the Niagara Mohawk Power Company became deregulated and lost so many of their safeguards because they were no longer required to. When the energy industry was deregulated, they deregulated four things: the price, the accounting system, the service conditions, and the political givings, which meant that when they deregulated, that also meant power companies could then give to politicians. And that all happened with George Bush II. 3 days.
Ladies and gentlemen, the truth is that mutants are very real, and they are among us.
To continue our story, though, here's Patrick with a story about what's wrong with the grid itself.
This comes from Harvey Wasserman of the Free Press in Columbus. The culprits in this latest northeastern disaster are basically the same: the barons of fossil and nuclear power and their cronies in the electric utility business. They're quote, weapon is an ancient electric grid that's so obsolete, if not obscene. It is a massively fragile Rube Goldberg device that dangerously and inefficiently carts around electricity from expensive, polluting, and extremely unsafe central generating plants to buildings that waste massive amounts of energy and generate none. That the grid will crash again and again and yet again is absolutely certain. The only question is, who are the real terrorists? Errant crazies who blow things up, or entrenched interests that refuse to change? The technology now exists to transcend this mess. In the mid-1990s, California's green energy advocates proposed a 600-megawatt mosaic of solar, wind, and other renewable generators that would have entirely prevented the fake deregulatory crisis of 2000 and 2001. It was approved by the California Public Utilities Commission, but then killed by Southern California Edison and the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. Today, the Bush administration wants to further subsidize its fossil and utility friends with the bad energy bill, and by pouring billions into so-called upgrading the electric grid. The only thing certain is that every cent of that money will be wasted. In 1952, a Blue Ribbon report to Harry Truman predicted the future of America's energy rested with the sun. It predicted 13 million solar power homes here by 1975. And the promise of a decentralized off-grid self-sufficiency. Instead, Dwight Eisenhower took us into the pit of the, quote, peaceful atom. $1 trillion later, we have a half-century of crashing grids and dangerous nukes that are vulnerable to terrorism and must shut down precisely when they're most needed, as they did during this latest blackout. The latest Bush energy bill only makes the situation worse, with more nuke subsidies and a powerful push for fossil fuels, especially coal, which coal has been called probably the most polluting and least efficient.
It's the largest contributor to greenhouse gases in the country. Aside from after cars, I think.
Yeah. Yet I think it's the largest percentage of Ohio's energy comes from coal plants, unfortunately.
We're gonna get all into the coal plants here in just
all
a second.
All into the coal.
Oh yeah. We're gonna look like miners.
Dirty soot.
Get black. We are miners, black and dirty.
So that was an article from Harvey Wasserman of the Free Press in Columbus.
Okay, so now that's what's wrong with the grid and like how the problems with the grid, the inherent structure of the grid. But we have another story that Stav's going to read that gets more into the danger of the grid and the dangers of the grid going down.
Well, with a new song, this is by Winona Hoder from Counterpunch. And she writes, "By all expert accounts, there was plenty of power available at the time of the blackout. But something or someone overloaded the wires to move it to markets. Electric deregulation provides incentives for just such overloads, since generators must sell as much as possible to make profits. Electric deregulation also provides incentives to make necessary repairs or additions to the transmission system, or to employ adequate maintenance personnel, because these essential measures diminish profits. Building and centralizing control over more high-voltage transmission lines will be expensive, especially if left to the market. This market is already demanding incentives for expanding the transmission grid. Such expansion benefits the generators by increasing their reach, but leaves the rest of the country even more vulnerable to widespread power outages, whether caused by greed for profits, terrorists, or simply by acts of God. The call by Senate Republicans for greater reliance on nuclear power must also be seen in a new light following the massive loss of electricity, which required 9 nuclear power plant reactors to shut down. Sudden reliance on backup diesel generators is less than reassuring, especially considering that there have been 15 instances in the past 12 months in which emergency generators have either malfunctioned or failed to operate at all, in certain cases leading to a plant shutdown. On several occasions, all backup generators failed at once. While a plant can last between 2 and 8 hours without backup generators before melting down, the concept of such a blackout leading to a nuclear meltdown is not at all beyond imagination or possibility. And if this blackout had caused a meltdown or other severe accident, it appears that the emergency sirens in place to alert the proper officials and the public would not have operated due to lack of power. In event reports submitted by the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission yesterday, both the Indian Point and Jena nuclear stations, both in New York, noted that some of their emergency sirens would have been rendered impotent due to the blackout. In the case of Indian Point, 4 surrounding counties would have been left in a tragic state of ignorance in the event of a meltdown.
Yeah, so basically the problem there is that these nuclear reactors that are hooked up to the grid, if they have to shut down immediately, we've only got backup reactors to shut them down. And I just read in the Plain Dealer today that what happened with the Perry nuclear reactor was the backup power was insufficient, and even though the rods that needed to be shoved into the core to shut the reactor down, they got in there. 7 of them were improperly put in because the systems malfunctioned, and now they can't get them out. So I guess we're really lucky that Davis-Bessie wasn't up and running, because that thing's got so many problems that had the power gone down on that, who knows what would have happened. But also the Detroit people were kind of in a sticky situation there, because it's very possible that their backup generators didn't work, as all 4 of them failed once on February 1st. If they had failed on August 14th, then there would have been a nuclear meltdown in Detroit. That's just the simple fact of playing around with nuclear energy. But now, with all that in mind, all the deregulation and all the rules that changed and all the things the government did to free up the energy companies recently to make more profit by slashing staff and getting rid of security measures and getting rid of, and you know, instead of mandating that they have backup measures in place, they suggest that they have backup measures in place. So with all that in mind, what actually caused the blackout? Well, this is an article from Cheryl Seal, who's a well-credentialed journalist writing for all kinds of environmental issues and writing mostly in progressive magazines. She provides us with 2 scenarios. One is the fabulous conspiracy theory that people love to talk about, and I'll just give you a quick glimpse of that. She says that it could have something to do with EMP pulses. And she writes, so what modus operandi could someone use to disable the entire northeastern power grid? The favorite conspiracy theory being fielded so far is an EMP, or an electromagnetic pulse. The U.S. military has been developing EMP weaponry for disabling aspects of enemy infrastructure, especially communication systems. A strategically targeted zap with such a weapon could theoretically have achieved the desired effect. Now, there's more information on that at abovetopsecret.com or org or net. Above Top Secret. They have lots of information, but considering that's kind of a left-field guess, she goes on to say, a far less exotic scenario is that someone at the Northeastern Power Station caused the cascade simply by failing to follow the rules, intentionally or unintentionally. As one engineer put it during an interview on August 15th, in the deregulated system, the new rules now are now suggested rather than mandatory. Even if caught, the guilty party would not be technically culpable. But the interesting part of her article is the plot thickens. Remember our story on the Peabody Coal Company in the Ohio Valley that we ran a couple weeks ago?
Yeah.
Yeah, remember they wanted to lop off the top of these mountains so they could mine for more coal? Okay, well, this is what she wrote. Another aspect of this energy crisis and the issues surrounding it may prove to have very significant bearing on the blackout. Ironically, I had started this article before the blackout on the morning of the 14th. On August 14th, a decision by the Bush administration panders to the Ohio Valley coal industry, leading supplier of coal to the power industry. When it came to handing more power over to the already bloated media through the proposed changes in FCC regulation, the Bush administration gave the public the bum's rush, allowing barely 6 weeks for comments and refusing to extend the public input period. Now, the coal industry is trying to fight proposed regulations that would protect the ravaged Appalachian environment from the devastating effects of lopping off the tops of mountains to cheaply extract the coal there. This hideous practice is ruining formerly pristine mountain streams and rivers. It isn't too surprising that there have been extremely few public comments opposing the proposed protective regulations. So what does the Bush administration do? It extends the deadline period. Not by the paltry 2 or 3 weeks the FCC issue got, but by over 4 months to January 4th of next year. That will give the corporazzis plenty of time to mobilize their freeper brigades, who will do their best to stuff the ballot box. Of course, the Bush case justifying topping is based on the supposedly urgent need for more and cheaper coal to fuel new power plants. And the need for new power plants, of course, has just been also conveniently highlighted by the mysterious power blackout. This event, with astonishingly opportune timing, occurred the very day it was announced that the time for comments on the mountain topping had been extended. No doubt the Bush and company imagined that the public would rush right out and clamor for mountaintop coal as a way to avoid another blackout. Little suspecting, of course, that the problem is not a power shortage but power distribution, which has nothing to do with coal. Now, this, of course, is getting into the theory that Bush knew about this and this was actually orchestrated. But I want to just give you this timeline because it is very interesting the way this all works to Bush's advantage with these two laws he's trying to get passed. This is just the timeline. August 5th, just a couple weeks ago, Bush's Clear Skies Initiative, which is set to replace the Clean Air Act, designed to all but overturn the Clean Air Act and give power-generating utilities a license to spew the worst greenhouse gases into the air in greater abundance. Actually, they will increase this. Bush's proposal would increase the amount of toxins allowed to be pumped into the air by 16%. Faces a stiff uphill battle in Congress in the coming weeks. The Bush EPA creates what amounts to a sales pitch for the initiative in its website, but opposition to the initiative is building, especially with the summer's abundant evidence of global warming. August 9 through 13. A mysterious computer worm disables several key indie media sites, rendering them unable to add new postings during the period of the blackout. The morning of August 14th. In the Ohio Valley in the coal mining district, the coal industry has aggressively been seeking to block regulations prohibiting them from trashing the environment by lopping off the tops of mountains to mine coal, a practice that has been devastating rivers and streams and desecrating the landscape. But so far, the public input period for regulations has yielded an overwhelming majority of anti-mining comments. On the morning of the 14th, the Bush administration allows the period for the public comment to be extended vigorously, outrageously, until January 4th of next year. Point to remember, the number one consumer of coal from the Ohio Valley is the electrical generation industry. Morning of August 14th as well. Bush is in California, distancing himself from the Northeast by 3,500 miles and placing himself at the side of the last mass electricity crisis, a crisis that proved to have been largely engineered by Ken Lay and other energy barons looking for easy billions. The afternoon of August the 14th, an inexplicably huge blackout hits the Northeast, including the Ohio Valley. The evening of August 14th, Bush makes a three-minute statement that includes a call already to upgrade the national power grid and, by extension, of course, the energy generating system, regulations, and all. He will repeat this call every single time he speaks for the next 24 hours, and no doubt beyond. Now, the evening of August 14th, several possible causes for the blackout are being fielded, but many people in the industry express suspicion that it was engineered. All this is something yet for you to consider. The last thing I want to mention off this woman's report, she says all through the night of August 14th and 15th, power engineering experts across the country were weighing in on the mysterious giant blackouts in the northeastern U.S. It shouldn't have happened, they said, not with the checks and balances built into that system. Lightning? There was no tangible sign of such an event, say eyewitnesses in the vicinity of the Niagara Falls power plant. In fact, the conditions weren't even right, according to meteorologists. Yes, a point blackout could have happened, but a massive cascade, something is fishy, and that has been the repeated assessment. And,
I have another report here.
Yeah, we're going to wrap this up with a report from England. This is from The Independent.
This is written by Andrew Gumbel. And the Bush administration rushed to defend itself yesterday from accusations that reluctance to upset its friends in the energy industry was to blame for the regulatory chaos leading to last week's massive power blackout across northeastern United States and Canada. President Bush's energy secretary, Spencer Abraham, popped up on the Sunday TV talk shows to insist that the administration was doing everything it could to update an electrical grid that, by his own admission, was already obsolete at a time of tremendous growth in demand. He said, quote, "We've identified the corridors where we need more transmission. We've been working with the states to upgrade and improve the identification of new technology. We've invested more than 50% in our budget on research." What new technology? I don't know. That was the end of his quote. None of that, however, answered the crucial question, which is how the most advanced economy in the world could experience the biggest blackout in its history and not even know why. Investigators have narrowed down the origin of blackout to a number of high-voltage transmission lines near Cleveland, Ohio. You know where that's at. Just over an hour before the lights went out, the first 345-kilovolt power line went down, a parallel line that automatically picked up the slack, then overloaded, sagged, and hit a tree, causing it to shut down. Those failures apparently initiated a chain reaction throughout the vast area administered by the North American Electric Reliability Council. First Energy, the utility responsible for the downed Ohio lines, said it did not become aware of the problem fast enough because its alarm system did not kick on. That does not explain, however, the rest of the Northeast was taken unawares, but most energy experts agree on the root causes of a failure many of them have been predicting for years. This is a bipartisan problem long predating President Bush's arrival in the White House. With corporate interests lobbying both main parties, no consensus has been reached on how to regulate the industry or provide incentives for its growth.
So to make a very, very long, complicated story short, and we will be following this up in the coming weeks, basically, no one really knows what exactly triggered the entire cascading effect to cause the entire Northeast to go out. They look at power lines in Northeast Ohio. Harvey Wasserman is ready to convince anybody on a dime that the First Energy Corporation is severely corrupt and poorly run. And the one thing that we do know is that the effects of deregulation have caused the energy industry to be left in shambles as they all run around and compete for our dollars. And one thing you can expect is that this has got amazingly coincidental timing with Bush's new energy policy, which seeks to give billions of dollars back to these industries that helped him get in office. At the same time, the coal, the production industries of coal mining, which also donated to not only Bush's campaign, but to a lot of Republicans here in the state of Ohio. So if we ever figure out what actually caused it, we'll let you know. But right now it sounds like the whole energy system is in just one big mess. Anyway, we're going to play a song. When we come back, Matthew T. and Marcel, somebody, are here to talk about the 20,000 Leagues Under the Industry Film Festival. That's coming up this weekend. I know that's a radical shift from blackouts to weekend film festivals, but that's what we're going to do anyway. And they're going to come in and talk to us a little bit about what we can expect and how we can get there when we come back in just a second.
WRUW presents the 22nd Annual Studio A Rama, a free all-day concert at the Mather Memorial Courtyard on the CWRU campus. It happens on Saturday, September 6th from 2 p.m. to midnight. Bring a blanket, bring snacks, bring the family. Just don't bring any glass bottles. Stay tuned to WRUW for all the details, and we'll see you on Saturday, September 6th. Studio A Rama. Don't miss it.
All right, and with that, here with me in studio are Matthew T, Marcel Dujour.
Yep.
Did I get it right that time?
You got it right.
Excellent.
Hey.
Hey, what's happening?
Nothing. Thanks for having us down, Chris.
Hey, sure. So 20,000 Leagues is this weekend, and it's what, the third, the fourth one?
The fourth, yeah, the fourth in Cleveland, the third time back at the Beach and Ballroom.
Okay, you got the whole darn thing, right?
Yeah, well, most of the weekend. Remember, we started Speaking Tongues in 2000.
Right.
And so, but this weekend, yeah, we're in the ballroom. All the films are in the ballroom all weekend, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. But then Saturday, we also have a show in that moves into the tavern. It starts in the ballroom and moves to the tavern.
Okay, very cool. What's that?
It's the Saturday night 8:30 film program. It's like how we started at Speaking Tongues. It's a marathon. It's 3 hours. There's an intermission. At the end of the shorts, it's all shorts. At the end of the shorts, Marcel's puppet troupe, the Cinnamon Roll Gang, performs.
Okay.
And that's in the ballroom because we need the space. And then Sean Carney, former Clevelander, will be back in town. Got a film in the festival. He's performing a piece of like avant-garde classical, I guess you'd call it. It's
is he Ralph Carney's brother?
I don't think so.
Okay.
I mean, I don't know Ralph Carney. So, but no, Sean came from Erie originally. But Robert Ashley is an experimental musician from the '60s. Did a piece called The Wolfman, very rarely ever performed, and it's a pre-recorded sounds, and then Sean does acoustic elements with his voice over it, and then Cleveland's own Lives of the Saints perform after. So it's puppets, and then avant-garde classic, and then rock.
Oh, okay, movies, puppets, rock.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, hey, we wanted to probe you on not really probe you, but ask you questions about the last time I made it to 20,000 Leagues was the one at the old Speaking Tongues, and I know Patrick's been to a couple of them since then, and it seems like you always include a couple films that have a lot of information that might be considered independent media almost, because a lot of, like, I know you premiered Horns and Halos last year, which
it's showing tonight. It's funny, the power blackout ties into it. It's showing at the Cinematheque because Thursday night their power went out. They couldn't do the Thursday night screening, and so it's repeating tonight.
Okay, well, there's an announcement. Horns and Halos at the Cinematheque tonight.
Yeah.
Yeah, we also at our festival we have a lot of work from the Guerrilla News Network.
Okay.
And one of them's a Ralph Nader speech, and another one is a guy by the name of Peter Dale Scott, who wrote a book called The War Conspiracy that was suppressed by the CIA in 1970. He's a professor over at Berkeley.
Okay.
And
so these are documentaries?
They're documentaries, but they're done like little, like, news shorts, and then they'll have like a background music track. And at first when we saw them, we were a little skeptical about, you know, having the hip hop like backing music, but then again, it's geared so that it can open it up to a younger audience that probably wouldn't just listen to a lecture.
Right, right.
So it's sort of there is an element of it that is, you know, you might question, but then when you realize that young people aren't going to go, they're not going to go seek out the information the same way, you know, it'll
many
take.
Many of them won't.
Many of them won't. So it's a lot of really good information, and it's really strong stuff, and they're set up in a way that they don't get, they're only about, what, 4 minutes?
Four to five, generally.
4 to 5 minutes, so it's
right.
Not like you get, doesn't,
right.
It doesn't drag on, it just punches it at you.
Like Countdown, the Ralph Nader piece that Marcel's talking about, it's originally, it's a piece of music that Ad Rock put together from, he did a remix of some of Nader's speeches, and then these guys took images from the same speeches, tracked down the images, and cut it together. And it's very hip, it's very fast, and there's a lot of, like, back and forth cutting. And the film The War Conspiracy that Marcel was speaking about was a book that's about how the Vietnam War was basically funded and backed by corporations, specifically, like, oil money was very involved in the parapolitics of what kept the war running.
Okay, so when are these movies actually showing? Because if I recall correctly, you can get into the festival a number of ways. You can do like the weekend pass deal, or you can do like a whole day package. But then you have different screenings, and
yeah.
you can get into those separately. So maybe you can let the listeners know like what time some of these are going to be showing. So, if, you know, they
well,
would count, be able to
Countdown, the first film that I was speaking about, which is the Ad Rocks remix of the Ralph Nader speech.
Yeah.
That's showing Friday night in the DIY or Die program. And that film's, I mean, the film's not necessarily political, but the message of DIY or Die is really strong. And it's all these artists like Richard Kern and Jim Thirlwell and Ian MacKay and Lydia Lunch and more.
Okay.
And it's about why they work in DIY. So I think it fits that program.
Right. And we're not allowed to say how much anything costs on college radio, but it's not going to.
It's affordable. It's the information's at our website at 20,000leagues.org.
Excellent. 20,000leagues.org. And what time was that DIY one start?
That program is at 8 o'clock on Friday.
8 o'clock
and
on Friday.
That includes the film Countdown, which is, like we're saying, the Ralph Nader film.
Okay.
And then afterwards, we're also going to have a DIY party at a location that we'll disclose only at the festival.
Like a rave?
No. Well, I mean, whatever you want to call it. It's local artists, local painters. And in fact, Ken Blaze is for the first time showing his Speaking Tongues photography. Ken is a photographer who shot Speaking Tongues the most of its 8-year run.
Right.
And he has a show of some really impressive work of people who were there, bands that played there, like the flavor. It's not all just shots of guys holding a mic.
Right. That's great.
Yeah.
And will we be able to get into the back of a U-Haul to get to this undisclosed location?
Yes.
Then it's a rave.
Yeah. I mean, if you rent a U-Haul, our budget doesn't include U-Hauls.
Okay.
There's also two other films of a political nature that are kind of
informational or so.
Yeah, they're more cute. They're guys who did The Waking Life and Marcel. So I didn't see The Waking Life.
We're big fans of Waking Life.
They made two shorts, and one's called Homeland Hoedown, and the other's called Stay the Union, and they're both. Mr. Bush is in both of them.
Yeah, it's they rotoscope George Bush and and Colin Powell and
rotoscoping is the way they did Waking Life, that
what?
Weird
yeah.
animation.
It's basically they paint you take an image, like an image from film and you paint over it, so you get almost an exact you get pretty close to the image
right.
of the person, but they do all this stuff with George Bush having like horns coming out of his head. One part of it. He's like he's got Julie Andrews' body, and he's doing the Sound of Music thing while he's talking, and they cut it up so that he's just like telling you know America needs drugs now, and then they keep going back to this part where he's like hello daddy, and then he goes into this speech and hello daddy, it's a really cool cartoon. And
awesome.
You see all these people all over, like listening to him. You see all these figures in politics listening to him, and at one point there's there's, let's see, Saddam Hussein, Bin Laden, and
Abu Zubaydah. Oh wait, no, that's in Homeland Hoedown.
Yeah, there's a part where there's all these like dictators, in little ballerina outfits dancing around, and some monkey dancing with them.
Okay.
As Bush is speaking and stuff, so it kind of lampoons them very well.
And that one he's talking about. State of the Union shows Saturday at the 8:30, which is the main event.
Okay.
But the Homeland Hoedown shows in a program called Northwest, which is a skater documentary,
okay.
which ties back into the whole DIY. I mean, this is where we came from, you know.
Right,
we do
right.
it. It's Marcel and I. It's ours. But the
we've got some information about skaters later on too.
Yeah, the film Northwest at 3 o'clock on Saturday contains the short Homeland Hoedown that we were also just talking about. And Northwest is about the guys who started Burnside, who are now building like these massive, huge skate parks around the Northwest. One of the companies is down at Skatopia right now building a park. Do you guys know what Skatopia?
Well, we've got a story about Lakewood skaters building that skate park out in Lakewood, but I don't know anything about Burnside.
Burnside was in Portland. It is in Portland. It started under a bridge.
Oh, they're the Northwest.
Yeah.
Northwest.
Yeah, Northwest. Yeah.
Wrong part of the country. Yeah, I don't know anything. You know, there's going to be a skate park in Lakewood, though.
Yeah, they've been raising money. In fact,
we're writing a story on it tonight.
Michael Larkey, local filmmaker, submitted a skater film we're showing at that.
Are you showing that one?
Yeah, it's called
okay,
October.
Great.
It's really good.
Great.
Which is fun. Like, I've seen a lot of skater films. We go to festivals, and there's always skater programs. And it's always New York or Tokyo or L.A. It's so nice to, like, see Cleveland. It really is. Like, you're like, oh, there's Tower
Moving
City.
Up.
I mean, they're still like, you know, they're still grinding, but it's like, oh, look, there's a terminal.
Right, right. That's cool. Well, is there any last info you guys want to get
out
there?
Yeah, also we got films made by children on Saturday
okay.
at 1 o'clock, and it's like, you know,
Sweet.
we basically...
Oh, is that the family segment, right?
Well, there's a family segment on Sunday that's all family-friendly films, but on Saturday we have films that were actually made by kids from Cleveland, Austin, Chicago, Los Angeles.
Oh, very cool.
Back in Los Angeles, I hang out at a place called the Echo Park Film Center. That is a community-based. It's a community center for kids to learn filmmaking, and there's cheap equipment you could either rent or buy. So, I wanted to start showing films made by children. Basically, they, you know, nobody, they can make a little film and show it to their family, but there's no real outlet. And so we're also giving away two cameras on Saturday.
Super 8.
To kids, yeah, two Super 8 cameras.
Oh, very cool.
And film.
Yeah, and a roll of film for each camera.
And our advice if they want it, they don't have to take it.
It's a pretty good reason to go borrow my friend's kids for the day.
Well, the kids win the cameras.
Oh,
No, the raffle's not good for, it doesn't, the raffle costs nothing, you just have to be under 18.
Bummer. I want a Super 8, too.
Well, we can work that out later.
Okay, cool. But hey guys, thanks a lot for coming.
Appreciate
down.
Your time.
Thank you.
Yeah, and there's hope a lot. Goes well.
The festival's really vast. 20,000leagues.org. I mean, not to pimp, but there's 8 programs. There's 116 films.
Yeah, not to pimp it. It keeps getting bigger every year too. Yeah. I mean, in the first year, oh man, that was like a
four
hellish
hours.
4 hours sitting inside the most cramped speaking tongues I've ever seen in my life.
Yeah. Well, hopefully it'll be just as cramped this weekend.
But a lot more people.
Yeah. Thanks for your time.
Okay, guys. Thanks a lot. Take care.
We'd like you to know that the views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of WRUW, Staff Interim Management, Case Western Reserve. It's the views of the website posters, the guests we just had in the studio, and of course, our own selves. Be right back. All right, we're back with you. And I think we have Patrick going to help
microphone.
You out with the blue triangle story here.
Yeah. Well, we have some audio that I got yesterday at a protest that happened at Public Square. Actually, there was a speak out in Public Square, and people went on a march, and I met up with them on the corner of East 9th and Euclid, I believe. Over by St. John's Cathedral. So we have that on CD, I believe. But let's see. Yeah. So it concerns the thousands of Muslim, Arab, and South Asian immigrants that have been detained since the USA Patriot Act went into effect. And on Monday, September 8, 2003, the Cleveland Blue Triangle Network has called for a day of protest in solidarity to stop the repression of Arab, Muslim Americans and South Asian Americans, and to join in solidarity with victims of homeland repression. We have the audio queued up. Okay. This is the audio that I got from yesterday at the protest.
So it's I'm here with Don and Grace, East 9th Street. And what brought people out here today in Cleveland?
We came out today for the Blue Triangle Network of Cleveland to show solidarity with the Arabs, Muslims, and South Asians that are being racially profiled, discriminated against, harassed by the authorities at this time. From local police on up to the immigration service, you know, to the Bush administration has been targeting certain ethnic groups because they feel, I guess the Bush administration's logic is they're going to make the country a little safer by rounding up people of Arab, Muslim, and South Asian descent and religion, because he's saying that these are terrorist nations where these people came from. You know, we're all immigrants, and there's no reason to be targeting certain sectors of society. This, you know, we live in a country where you have freedom of religion, we have due process, we have certain freedoms, and these constitutional rights are supposed to stand up even during times of supposed war, terror, whatever. You know, we will stand by these immigrants because a lot of them are just like you and I, and they're not connected with any kind of terrorism. They're family members. They have kids, wives, and these men are being secretly detained by the government, and that's why we're here today.
Can you give us an example of like what things are happening to families locally here in Cleveland or the Cleveland area?
Sure. You know, you can hear a lot of anecdotal stories, and the reason why they're anecdotal at this time is because people are really afraid to speak out because then they feel like they'll be targeted. And we know that there's harassment occurring in Cleveland. We know that families are living in fear. We know that agents of the INS or the government have been to certain homes, and we're asked not to speak about it. And so we can't, of course, we won't give any names, but these are happening. We're going to keep telling these stories. We know of some documented stories, one in Kent, Ohio, and some in Detroit, and around the nation. You know, there's many, 13,000 to be, roughly, men are being detained and deported at this time. They registered, volunteered to register in the last few months, and now the government is detaining and deporting these men for minor immigration violations. Some are actual citizens, and some are not. And yes, it is happening right here in our city and in our surrounding area. Back in December of last year, January and February, and a few other months after that, every month there was various groups of ethnic groups that had to go register. The men, 18 and over, only the men of certain ethnic and religious beliefs had to register with the INS, and they did go. And now they're being detained and deported. You know, like it was for no reason other than the color of their skin and their names or their belief in a certain religion.
A lot of people have been comparing it to the internments of Japanese Americans during the World War II.
Absolutely, that's correct. Yeah, it is a lot like the World War II internment of the Japanese Americans. They're being stripped of their citizenship, or their rights. Actually, some are citizens. There's the man in Kent. He's a U.S. citizen. He's been here for many years. Mr. Al-Jalani, his kids are now in foster care. One of our members of the group today did go to the hearing last week for the custody. We're asking that the hearings be held open. And also, maybe Grace will say something about that, but we're asking folks to call the Congress and stop these taxpayer-funded flights out of this country filled with men of Arab, Muslim, and South Asian descent, and they're being shipped out on taxpayer flights, and they're in secret. This is all going on in secret, and we want to shine a light on it. We want to be open, and we have a right to know that this is happening.
So we also have Grace here, and maybe she can tell us a little bit more about what's going on with the family of the man from Kent who's currently being held, detained, and what's going on with their family.
Mr. Al-Jalani is from Kent, Ohio. He's also a permanent U.S. resident, and he's been held behind bars for 10 months despite a ruling in March from immigration judge Walt Durling that held that the FBI failed to present evidence to continue to hold him. What happened is the Department of Homeland Security blocked Judge Durling's order to release Al-Jalani. As a result of his detention and his wife's recent depression when her husband became detained, his children were separated from their parents and put into foster care in Portage County. Last Tuesday there was a hearing in Portage County Juvenile Court on whether future hearings over the children should be open or closed to the media. A decision was made today on that issue. However, when I called Portage County Juvenile Court at 3:30, they would not tell me what the decision was. They said I had to contact one of the attorneys. However, at that hearing last week, the attorneys for the Plain Dealer and for the Akron Beacon Journal really, I thought, excellently defended the First Amendment. They succeeded in getting the prosecution's witness to admit that better reporting would result if they could be in the courtroom. They also succeeded in getting the prosecution's witness to admit that it would be reasonable for a father like Al-Jalani, who is jailed and not charged with a crime, to seek help from outside sources. And it's my belief that when someone like Al-Jalani is held in jail and not charged for months at a time, if you can't call on the media to help you, then who can you call on? The government's going to just keep on secretly detaining and arresting people, and it's all secretive and it's all under wraps and it's unconstitutional.
Did either of you have anything more you wanted to discuss on the subject?
One last thing. I'd like to invite you all to an event where Blue Triangle Network of Cleveland is holding on September 8th at 5 o'clock. We're going to be meeting at the Beit Hanina Hall at 10301 Lorraine Avenue, and this will be a solidarity protest and march and rally with food and music afterwards. So we're starting at 5, going until whatever. It's a Monday night. It's September 8th.
Okay. Thanks a lot. All right. That was Don Bryant of the Cleveland Blue Triangle Network talking about a rally they're going to have in September on Monday, as you said. And in the announcement, the Cleveland Blue Triangle says the fearmongers tried with the, quote, internment of the Japanese Americans during World War II and with the McCarthy's lists in the 50s, and now the Bush administration is continuing with an ongoing campaign of discrimination, profiling, and demonizing of certain immigrants based on skin color, religious beliefs, ethnicity, under a veil of secrecy, and misguided attempts to rid the nation of, quote, terrorist threat. So also in that, there will be a rally at 5, as you mentioned, at 6. There will be a march to say no more secret trials, roundups, and detentions of immigrants, and no more deportations. And also some the march will be turning to the Beit Hanina Social Club at 7 p.m. for some food and entertainment. Right. For more information, you can contact, you can call 440-237-0673 or clevelandbluetriangle@yahoo.com. And to add a little to the Grace was talking about, the family from Kent, that the man is being detained in Pennsylvania. He has not been charged with anything. He's been sent to a prison for alleged links to terrorists, and his wife is currently being treated for there's an article written by the Akron Beacon Journal. It was a while ago, and it says the last 7 months have been a nightmare for Michelle Swanson, a bad dream that just keeps getting worse. She got a phone call from the INS, and an agent told her that her husband was in custody and he was going to be deported. And she was upset, and her life was turned upside down. A doctor who was treating her felt her condition was worsening and ordered her hospitalized on June 2nd. The same evening, Kent police came to their home and took her Portage County social workers and took the couple's three children. The three children were placed in foster care, and the Portage County Department of Job and Family Services has alleged in paperwork that Swenson is incapable of providing a safe and secure environment for her children, and they seek to have permanent custody of the children put in foster care. So you could read that article on our newswire at cleveland.indymedia.org. We're going to move on with the rest of the program.
Well, we wanted to do some announcements. Attorney General John Ashcroft will be here in Cleveland tomorrow. That's Wednesday, August 20th. He's going to be visiting a few cities. He'll be in Philly on Wednesday also. Then he moves on Thursday to Detroit and Des Moines. So tomorrow he'll be at the Renaissance Hotel Gold Room, 24 Public Square, at 12:50 p.m. That's just after noon, like 10 minutes to 1 o'clock. He's visiting law enforcement personnel.
Word has it from the Liberty Think website that he is going on putting on a road show to garner support for the Victory Act, which is a brand new act that has just been leaked to the media, which is it's not the same as the Domestic Security Enhancement Act, known as Patriot Act 2, but it contains similar provisions that would further erode individual liberties, and it's just more of the draconian provisions targeted for defunding for defunding by the House of Representatives, and he's apparently out to promote this. So,
also Latino Del Norte Music and Arts Festival in Lorraine this weekend, and Friday, August 29th, Critical Mass Bike Ride, don't forget.
And finally, I just want to let everybody know that the ACLU is suing over the key provisions of the USA Patriot Act. In what may become a landmark case in constitutional law, the American Civil Liberties Union filed the first legal challenge to the USA Patriot Act on July 30th. The ACLU cites target section 215 of the law, which empowers the FBI to search the records and property belonging to innocent U.S. citizens and legal immigrants. The case was filed on behalf of the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee and several other secular and religious organizations representing Arabic, South Asian, and Islamic communities whose members have been frequent subjects to an investigation under the Patriot Act. Kind of ties in with Patrick's story there.
All right, so Chris, when were you were at the Vans Warped Tour, right?
Yeah, we were at the Vans Warped Tour, and the bands were stinky, but there was the Lakewood Skaters Association was there, and they were pretty cool. And I got to interview the guy. We're going to go out with this 3-minute interview.
All right, so I guess that's it. Later,
Stay tuned for Voices and Choices.
LakewoodSkaters.org. That's spelled out, just LakewoodSkaters.org.
Okay, and the planned site for the skate park is, like, already in a current Lakewood park that has, like, what, on the beach or something, or...?
It's right in Lakewood Park, which is right on Lake Avenue, right up on the lake, and it's part of the Lakewood Park complex, which includes a pool, about 7 or 8 tennis courts, a couple softball diamonds.
So it'll be right in the thick of the whole park
exactly.
For everybody to enjoy.
Yep. It'll be right there. It'll be more or less open to the public, lit till 11 p.m. or whatever park hours are. It will be lit, and it will be fenced in, but it won't be... it's not going to be supervised, but there'll be plenty of people there, so it'll be a really safe place to bring younger kids, but it'll be really just a cool location for all the guys that have been driving all the way out to Louisville or Mason,
right.
Michigan, or all the really good public skate parks, of which there are none around Cleveland, so we'll finally have one right here.
So what will happen to the Lakewood Skaters Association once the park is finally built?
Well, we started organizing because of this skate park. But the more we get into it, the more we got parents coming out of the woodwork and some of the older guys that are still around and skating hard all the time, we just agreed that we should form around just a general skaters association and start to put on events for the shops, for the kids, so we can get the skating community together and not have it so disbanded and broken up around the state. And so we've been holding clinics for young kids. We've been holding ramp jams out at people's ramps that have, like, let us use it. So we're not really forming a league or anything like that, but we've got a little bit of, you know, clout with, like, a website and stuff, so we can let people know when things are going on, so you can either bring your kids to it or hook up with your buddies and go to it. So it's really loose. No one's a member. You're a member, but it's not like you have to pay to be in, and there's no uniform or anything like that.
Right.
But it's loose enough where, like, we can pull off a little bit bigger stuff, more fun stuff, if we all work together. Our group will be around even after the park is built, so we can keep putting on events. Now that we have a park, we've got a location where we can hold more stuff, like a bowl contest or just smaller contests. We can bring in pros to do demos and stuff. So,
Have you been involved with the Gravity Games? Because, I mean, that happens downtown. I mean,
the Gravity Games.
You would help sponsor something like that in the future, having the nice park for.
Well, it definitely won't be big enough to have a really large, like, national event, and that's not what we went out to do. We're not trying to address these bigger issues or these bigger national events like the Warped Tour or Gravity Games or the Triple Crown. This is for Cleveland skaters, and that's what we designed it for. And we're not ever going to have an event where we bring in skaters from out of town so you can sit and watch them. It's going to be for the skaters of Cleveland to skate. So when we hold an event, that's who's going to skate, and that way the city and the parents can start to see that there is an enormous amount of talent and devoted skaters and a whole skating community that really doesn't necessarily have a place to go. LakewoodSkaters.org. That's spelled out, just LakewoodSkaters.org.
You're listening to WRUW-FM Cleveland. This hour, it's Voices and Choices, a weekly pro-choice and progressive radio program dedicated to educating and sharing, through our research and activism, what we have learned. We are people who understand that in order to promote change, people need to know the truth and hear what is going on from voices who are otherwise not heard. We will give a mic to those voices and lives as much as we possibly can. Our desire is to let people know that reading and discussion, while good, require action in order to generate change. Please remember that the views expressed on Voices and Choices are not necessarily those of Case Western Reserve University, WRUW, or its staff. I hope this is one of the...